This is Taking Aim with
Rob Schoenman
and Maya Schoen, coming to you Tuesday, December 9th, 2003. Testing the Waters, Military Rule in America, Part 2. Military rule in America, is it so far-fetched? Not according to General Tommy Franks, who led the U.S. forces in the attack on Afghanistan in 2001 and the invasion of Iraq earlier this year. General Tommy Franks retired shortly after the completion of the first stage of the invasion of Iraq. Yet, in Cigar Aficionado, there is a very long, over 20-page interview with him in which he states that the potential of a weapon of mass destruction being used in some casualty-producing event in somewhere in the Western world, whether it's in the United States particularly, that will cause, quote, our population to question our own constitution and to begin to militarize our country in order to avoid a repeat of another mass casualty-producing event, which, in fact, he states, then begins to unravel the fabric of our Constitution. That is General Tommy Franks, and his words were echoed in an opinion piece by Thomas Friedman of the New York Times, stating that another 9/11 would again unravel the Constitution and bring about militarization of rule in the United States. Ralph?
Well, you have to keep in mind that these are not just probes that test the water and accustom the population to the notion and prepare the media to disseminate the prospect and the probability. But with the Hannibal Lecter of American journalism, Thomas Friedman, who is really a jock sniffer of repression in every society for the American rulers, who gets off on it. He got off on it in the Balkans, he gets off on it in the Gulf, and now he's orchestrating the theme that the inevitable 9/11 that is to come will prepare us for the removal of constitutional protections in a formal sense. These are the satraps of the militarization of this society, and they are not talking abstractly.
The origins of the American military coup of 2012 is an article, a major piece by Lieutenant Colonel Charles J. Dunlop, Jr. Charles J. Dunlop, Jr. was a deputy staff judge advocate at CENTCOM, the very place in which General Tommy Franks had been in charge. Dunlop is in the United States Air Force. And as a piece for the Military War College, he wrote an article, The Origins of the American Military Coup of 2012, in which he has a hypothetical unification of all the military services taking place in 2007, leading to a coup in 2012. A coup in which General Thomas E.T. Brutus, Commander-in-Chief of the Unified Armed Forces of the United States, occupies the White House as a permanent military plenipotentiary. As Dunlop writes, scattered disorders still prevail and arrests for acts of sedition are underway. A senior retired officer of the Unified Armed Forces, known here simply as Prisoner 222-305759, is one of those arrested, having been convicted by court-martial for opposing the coup. Prior to his execution, he is able to smuggle out of prison a letter to an old War College classmate discussing the origins of the American military coup of 2012. And in it, he argues that the coup was the outgrowth of trends visible as far back as 1992. Now, this article, The Origins of the American Military Coup of 2012, won prestigious awards from the military itself. Ralph?
We have to keep in mind here that Colonel Dunlap was presented with the award as co-winner of the War College Award by the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and it was a strategy essay competition. It was granted this award and disseminated and promoted and orchestrated, in fact, as a scenario that had a putative fictional character. But as Dunlap himself pointed out, his origins of the American military coup are rooted in 96 footnotes. And indeed, every aspect of his scenario is derived from documents that are from foreign policy, from Pentagon releases, from RAND Corporation studies. The footnotes themselves are a manifestation of the non-fictional roots of this essay that was granted an enormous amount of attention and orchestration by receiving the co-chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff Award. And if you look carefully at the footnotes as we have, you'll see that every aspect of the timing of the preparation for a military coup in the United States is derived from specific documents that show the evidence of this in reality.
A form of this article, of this major work by Dunlop, appeared in Parameters in the winter of 1992 to 1993. 20 pages, and is available on the internet, and I recommend you go to read it. In it, Dunlop states that Brutus, the commander-in-chief of the Unified Armed Forces, quote, had to fill the power vacuum, and he really knew how to use power. He declared martial law, postponed elections, and got the vice president to retire, and moved into the White House. And when Congress convened, they passed a referendum act. But what they did with the referendum act, Congress, that is, they approved Brutus's takeover, much in the way that our current American Congress approved the military spending for the Iraq and the Afghanistan attacks, and also gave the president full powers to do what he saw fit in those invasions. Look at some of the aspects of this. According to Dunlop, Americans became exasperated with democracy. We were disillusioned, he writes, with the apparent inability of elected government to solve the nation's dilemmas. We were looking for someone or something that could produce workable answers. The one institution of government in which the people retained faith was the military.
Maya, this is a completely disingenuous citing of evidence from U.S. News and World Report and the Washington Post magazine pertaining to the alienation of the mass of American workers and of the voting population in the United States. Mortimer B. Zuckerman in Beyond Our Loss of Faith in U.S. News and World Report in 1992 March wrote, 91% of Americans report that the people who have too little influence in government are those like themselves. And indeed, the Washington Post magazine cited that 63% of those who fail to vote don't see any difference between the two major parties, and a substantial percentage of Americans is pessimistic about the country's domestic problems ever being solved by either of the two parties or those in office. And what is being cited here by Dunlap is the rationalization for a military coup rooted in the failures of capitalism and the desire of the public for a political alternative that responds to their needs. So the coup is as much an anticipation of a potential radicalization, disaffection, alienation, and incipient challenge to the established order as it is an expression of any presumptive desire on the part of the public to be ruled over by a fascist cabal.
And the fascist cabal recognized that there had to be extraordinary events in order for the population to accept military solutions. And Dunlop addresses this in this amazing piece.
By the year 2000, he writes, let me just cite this, Maya, the armed forces had penetrated vital aspects of American society. More and more military officers sought the kind of autonomy in nominally civilian affairs that they would expect from their military superiors in the execution of combat operations. Thus began the inevitable politicization of the military, with the responsibility for virtually everything government was expected to do. The military increasingly assumed a large role, in fact a decisive role, in policy making.
He cites commentator James Fallows in an article in 1991 in the Atlantic magazine, and this is in reference to creating special circumstances in order to affect military solutions, circumstances such as 9/11. Quote, musing on the contributions of the military to American society, Fallows wrote, and quote, I am beginning to think that the only way the national government can do anything worthwhile is to invent a security threat and turn the job over to the military. And in the Atlantic in August 1991, Fallows elaborated.
Martin Anderson in the Baltimore Sun is amongst the 96 citations Dunlap, the Baltimore Sun for April 14th, 1991. Our warriors are kindler and gentler and have not shown the slightest inclination to lust for political power. The potential lurks where power and respect converge. The degree of military influence in society is increasing out of all proportion and will assume a decisive role in the years ahead. So where we have the nominal fictive character of this predictive essay, the citations are all in the actual preparation of the public and the devastating demonstration that the military itself is preparing in this very series of citations for the role that is described by Dunlap.
Aside from extraordinary security threats, which Fallows had said inventing the extraordinary security threats, such as 9/11, creating them, another aspect Dunlap states is to transform what happens in the United States to national security issues. And in 1981, during the Reagan administration, the first step was taken with the Military Cooperation with Civilian Law Enforcement Agencies Act. That is the drug war. And with the drug war was the break in the line of the Posse Comitatus Act that dated back to the Civil War, in which the military and the policing operations in the United States were kept separate. When Congress passed the Military Cooperation with Civilian Law Enforcement Agencies Act, it allowed the military to participate with other enforcement agencies to, quote, combat drug trafficking, and it formally declared that it was a high national security mission. Also around this time, in the District of Columbia, National Guardsmen were used in high crime areas. Again, in 1986, another incredible law was passed. Public Law 99661. Now, these are not Dunlop's musings. These are actual laws that took effect in the United States. And in this Public Law 99661, valid military missions were authorized by law, including humanitarian missions as a model for the future. Ralph?
The drug war pretext has a very specific content. In Colombia, the drug war is the pretext for the wholesale terrorizing of the peasant population by special assassination squads officered by the United States. Under the cover of the drug war, it is not drugs that are interdicted, but resistance to military rule in those societies themselves. Under the cover of the drug war, drugs are funneled into the United States through MENA, Arkansas, the supply of drugs from the Middle East, the supply of drugs from Southeast Asia had always assumed both a military and a central intelligence agency proportion. So the invocation of the drug war is, in fact, the policing of the distribution of the drugs into the United States to the profits of the few, and then that becomes the rationale for the invasion and the intrusion and the permeation of all society by the military itself. All of this is expressed rather clearly in the Pittsburgh Daily Courier by John W. Whitehead on May 27, 2003. The year is 2012, and the president has just died, and General E. Thomas U. Brutus has persuaded the vice president to take not to take the oath of office. And here Whitehead, referring to the Dunlap piece, says, "Sounds far-fetched?" No, he says, "there's a convincing scenario for a takeover of the United States by the military. People have to understand that the armed forces are seen as the only vehicle that can bring order in this society." And indeed, we have already traveled far down this road, Whitehead writes in the Pittsburgh Daily Courier. He says the armed forces are turning out the most disciplined figures who are more effective in solving public problems than the nominal representatives in Congress. The military is surpassing every other institution in American society. Dunlap's concerns about the military are cited in a series of documented references. The military will fix civil problems. The increasing use of the military to patrol borders, the increasing role of the military in policing the cities, the increasing role of the military to avail themselves of billions of dollars of counter-narcotic crusades, the increasing presence of American troops as an adjunct to police forces in every state in the country, where military uniforms in streets and buildings and airports which had once drawn stares are no longer even raising an eyebrow of concern, writes John Whitehead in the Pittsburgh Daily Courier on December 1st of this year. And the Claremont Institute, in an article by McCubbin Thomas Owens earlier on September 1st, 2002, presents the same set of data. On the one hand, the openness of the public finance system seen in deficit financing enabled an administrative state to develop. On the other hand, the military, reflecting its employment at diverse tasks, is preparing for a takeover through its overuse. These problems are such that the administrative state seeks increasingly the military to supply domestic security for its own rule. And indeed, the Claremont Institute analysis of the Dunlap document roots its citations in the very evidence that gave rise to the Dunlap piece itself. McCubbin Thomas Owens, professor of strategy and force planning at the Naval War College in Rhode Island, a fellow of the Claremont Institute, once again orchestrates the theme for which we are being prepared, not just by Dunlap or Tommy Franks, but in the established media. Through its think tank institutions associated with the military, we are being conditioned and prepared for the military takeover of this society.
This led us to revisit important articles that appeared in 1997 as a result of the research of Peter Krasker and Victor Capella, professors at the School of Police Studies at Eastern Kentucky University. Their article in Social Problems in February 1997 was entitled "Militarizing American Police, the Rise and Normalization of Paramilitary Units." What they did was to trace the rise of paramilitary units within police departments of American cities, and they conducted a survey of 690 police departments of cities with populations of 50,000 or more. A metaphor of war is how Kraska and Capella termed it. They said that the policymakers were leading the nation's police departments to increasing militarization, which is defined as, quote, "a set of beliefs and values that stress the use of force and domination as appropriate means to solve problems and gain political power."
While glorifying the tools to accomplish this military power, the hardware, the technology, and their application is the continuation of that quote. "The military, including the National Guard, are increasingly assigned the task of what were once considered police duties. There is, quote, a close ideological operational alliance between these two entities in handling all domestic social problems, a process that is usually associated with the most repressive governments, unquote. In the post-war, Cold War American era, Kapler and Krasner write, in the United States, the military and the police have been integrated on a wider array of problems, problems essential to the contemporary condition of the African-American male. For, as the authors note, these developments signal not only a strengthening of the criminal justice industrial complex, but an absolutely intimate collaboration between the criminal justice industrial complex and the military industrial complex in the post-war era.
And so, endemic in the police departments are the paramilitary units, the PPUs, which wield greater power and the number of weaponry, with uniforms resembling ninjas with full body armor, helmets, and goggles, and special technologically advanced weapons. The creeping militarization of social problem resolution, military force, weaponry, and technology.
And these are all citations from Krasner and Kapler's seminal study. The overall police departments are impacted by the enthusiasm for high-tech weaponry, for military solutions, the dark underside, they cite, of so-called community policing, which has swept through the nation's municipal police departments from one end of the United States to the other. The recent popularization, they write, of the New York City Police Department's focus on zero tolerance of petty and minor offenses has essentially been assigned to counterinsurgency forces in the guise of policing. You have here, in fact, the conversion of the population of our inner cities into targets, much as were the Vietnamese during the counterinsurgency operations, the policy of scorched earth, of barbed wire internment camps that characterized the treatment of the population in Vietnam, and which have now been the paradigm for policing our cities and our population and our oppressed and our impoverished and our exploited in the United States. For these authors, this militarization has impacted police tactics to the point where they are the defining operation of community policing. And they quote a police commander on the paramilitary unit operations with respect to the day-to-day normal activity of what they call policing. Quote, "We conduct saturation patrol. We do military Terry stops and aggressive field interviews. We are relentless in this. The key to our success is that we are a militarized elite crime-fighting unit that is not bogged down in petty administrative restraint or bureaucracy. We focus on every aspect of life, quality of life issues, from illegal parking, loud music, bums, and neighborhood troubles. We have the freedom to go into hot areas, and we clean them up. Our tactical enforcement teams work nicely with our militarization of community policing." Quote, unquote. Here is the process that Dunlap is only orchestrating, already in place, as described by Krasner and Kapler.
And where does it lead? In North Carolina, Operation Ready Rock, where an entire block in an African-American neighborhood was raided, and nearly 100 people were detained and searched. And yet no prosecutions resulted from the raid. Despite the lawsuit, the successful lawsuit of the people in the neighborhood, the police maintained that what they did was correct. And if you look at some of the training of these PPU and SWAT teams, as Kraska did, he noted one officer pointed to the T-shirts that his team members wore. Embossed with a drawing of a burning city, the caption read, quote, "Operation Ghetto Storm." The training is done by special forces, the military special forces, and also the companies that sell the weapons. Some of these companies, like Heckler and Koch, which was a major German company, has now moved its headquarters to the United States. They carry out week-long tactical training sessions with submarine guns, which they sell at $1,200 or so a piece, making them affordable for the many police departments.
And this has been memorialized in a very important article by Peter Cassidy, The Rise in Paramilitary Policing, which appeared in Covert Action Quarterly of our good friend Lou Wolfe in fall of 1997. And it is a paradigm of exactly what we have been describing up to this moment. Operation Ghetto Storm indeed. Quote, at 4:30 a.m., the first wave of militarized SWAT teams clothed in battle dress uniforms with black hoods wielding submachine guns and military uniforms swarm into homes in the rural community in Washington State. 150 officers execute search warrants alleging that the residents were running a massive cooperative for marijuana. The multi-jurisdictional SWAT team members come from 13 separate police agencies, including the Federal Drug Enforcement Administration, the Bureau of Tobacco, Alcohol, and Firearms, the Washington Air National Guard, the Washington State Patrol, county sheriffs, SWAT teams, four city police departments, all integrated in a military operation. Quote, a massive, essentially, military operation. Terrorizing children asleep in their beds. Hooded figures bursting in. Automatic weapons at the ready. Officers putting guns at the head of a three-year-old, according to witnesses, ordering him down on the floor. And the details are instructive. As Cleve Atwater attended his customers at a club and pool room in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, the door splintered open and a mob of men in ninja hoods and military fatigues with automatic weapons rushed in and shouted for people to get down on the floor. Atwater slipped out while his bar assistant sprawled face down in a pool of his own terror-provoked urine. And in relation to this elaborate piece of The Rise in Paramilitary Policing by Peter Cassidy is the following. Selling SWAT by Lynn Wilson. There has now become across the United States an intense competition by arms manufacturers to provide high-tech equipment in helping fuel the explosion in the militarized police special tactical units. These SWAT teams are decked out in the full battle dress uniforms and are raising questions everywhere of not just police success, but the militarization of these police. Weapons manufacturers, as you cite, Maya, like Heckler and Koch and Smith and Wesson, are hawking their wares to every police department in the United States. Training camps, competitions, tactical training salesmen, submachine guns at $1,200 a piece, surrealistic ads pushing this weaponry, and BDUs and looking like Sylvester Stallone movie promos. In the risky business of forced entry, you need all the leverage you can get. An ad by Safariland Limited, manufacturer of military tactical body armor. And the largest seller of the submachine gun weapon to police units across the United States, as you say, Heckler & Koch, the German weapons manufacturer, is now based in Virginia. The MP5, the German machine pistol, was the choice for the British SAS, the German military, the U.S. Navy SEALs, and now the Los Angeles Police Department. In fact, 80% of local and state police SWAT teams use versions of the HNK MP5 submachine gun, with all these departments arming dozens of officers with high-powered military weapons. This is a detailed state-by-state, city-by-city description of how within the police, the elite, militarized unit have fueled a culture of violence, racial repression, and antagonism. This is the war on Black America. This is but one aspect of the militarization of our society.
You are listening to Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen on WBAI 99.5 FM in New York and on the internet at www.wbai.org. Our program today, Testing the Waters, Military Rule in America, Part 2. Nowhere is this more apparent than in New York City itself. And Frank Morales wrote, "The militarization of the police, again in Covert Action Quarterly, the spring-summer of 1999. This was at the moment of the assassination of Amadou Diallo, 22 years old, February 5, 1999, when he was killed in a hail of bullets in the vestibule of his apartment in the Bronx. He was shot by four white officers of the New York City Police Department, plainclothes, street crime unit. He was struck by 19 of the 41 shots, and he died on the way to the hospital. Those police were acquitted on February 25, 2000, and then a Justice Department investigation of the abrogation of Diallo's rights stated that no federal charges were warranted, and that was on January 31, 2001. In fact, the police commander didn't even reprimand the four officers. And this was despite massive demonstrations in New York City. What does Frank Morales describe about the militarization of the police, what he calls the commandos of the New York Police Department, the street crime unit? In Philadelphia, this was called the Civic Affairs Unit, and it's the Civic Affairs Unit that led the assault against MOVE and against MOVE and also other communities in Philadelphia. New York City Police Commissioner William Bratton at the time encouraged his men to become far more aggressive. And this was at the time of Mayor Giuliani's so-called quality of life crackdown on criminalization of people of color, especially the young, the poor, and the homeless. What the street crime unit wore were T-shirts, quote, "Certainly there is no hunting like the hunting of men." And their slogan was, quote, "We own the night."
And they also used the T-shirts that were common to the special forces, including those of the Contras in Central America, "Kill them all, let God sort it out later." But what's instructive about this is Frank Morales, our good friend, describes, the reports confirm that across America, police killings are on the up, a 230% increase in a space of 7 years. There is little record keeping of police homicides, like the nameless graves at Potter's Field. Amnesty International reports that since 1994, the federal government has been legally required to collect national data on the police use of excessive force, but Congress has systematically failed to provide the funding necessary for it. There is no accurate national system of data on the number of people fatally shot by police officers. Those who state that police killings have decreased over the last 20 years rely upon a document called Deadly Force, What We Know, which was produced by the Police Executive Research Foundation and is in complete contradiction to the findings of Amnesty International. Indeed, there has been a 500% growth in the activity of police military SWAT-type units across the United States, with an explosion of unreported deaths, disappeared individuals, and the masked burial of police victims in military uniform.
In New York City, there is a long history of the militarized police. In the 1970s, the New York Police Department had the Bureau of Special Services, BOSS. And the BOSS functioned in this role, as Morales states, quote, "It bore a distinction akin to that of the Green Berets, and they saw themselves in a war of survival. They particularly targeted the Black and Latino liberation movements in New York City." In December 1997, two former New York Police Department undercover detectives told the story of the most secretive units within the police department. These units functioned as, quote, a black desk in the mid-1980s, and they aimed at investigating dissident black groups and their leaders. The unit worked out of the Protective Research Unit, which was in the Public Security section of the New York Police Department's Intelligence Division, which at the time was headed by Deputy Chief Robert Burke. In particular, WBAI's own Lumbe Brass Patrice Lumumba Coalition was a target of investigation by this Protective Research Unit, as well as the December 12th Coalition, which at the time was known as the New York 8. This harkened back to the Red Squad in New York Police Department, Frank Morales writes. The Red Squad that investigated supposed communists and political activists in the McCarthy era. In the 1960s, it was known as the Bureau of Special Investigations, and it particularly focused on Malcolm X and later the Black Panthers. On and on throughout the history of New York, you have these militarized police units. But today, it has reached a point far beyond what was ever envisioned in the 1970s, the 1980s. And much of this happened during the Clinton administration, when Clinton authorized the technology transfer from defense concealed weapons detection, which called for the transfer of military technology to domestic police organizations to, quote, better fight crime. This took place in 1995. And as Morales states, this directive ensured the formalization of the direct militarization of the police.
In fact, Maya, the Clinton administration orchestrated this on a large scale, resulting in a 300% buildup since 1997. Police Commissioner William Bratton, as you say, cited that the men would have become far more aggressive, particularly 400 white officers along with a 7,000-strong narcotics unit engaged in a military operation under the very slogan you cited, no hunting like the hunting of men. And indeed, the Clinton administration extended the police-military connection by mandating that the Department of Defense and Associated Private Industries form a partnership with the Department of Justice to, quote, engage the crime war with the same resolve that they fight military operations and conducted the Cold War itself. This program was entitled Technology Transfer from Defense, Concealed Weapons Detention, the Transfer of Military Technology to All Domestic Police Organizations, Direct Transfers Previously Made to Client Foreign Governments, the formal presentation of a program for counterinsurgency and for the militarization of the suppression of the poor, of the dissident, and particularly of Black America in every city in the United States.
In part one of our program, we went into great detail about the role of the Northern Command in consolidating intelligence operations in the United States. Also, let's look again at the Clinton administration, June 1995. The Joint Chiefs of Staff produced publication 3-07, the Joint Doctrine for Military Operations Other Than War. That's the MOOTW. Now, this is very important because it really furthered the development of the Northern Command. The MOOTW are, quote, types of operations that include, quote, military support to civil authorities, under which Homeland Defense and the recently commissioned Homeland Command operations are to be conducted. Civil disturbance operations are situated within the doctrinal sphere of military support to civil authorities. With the development of the Homeland Security Department and the Northern Command, this has been embedded in the day-to-day tasks, the joining of the military and the police throughout the United States. It dates back to Operation Garden Plot, too, and the, as we mentioned before, the so-called War on Drugs and the Militarized Southern Border, which is Joint Task Force 6.
Here's how it works. Hundreds of paramilitary police units have been trained, quote, with active duty military experts in special operations. Another 60% were trained with special operations experience in the military. A special operations trainer had this to say. We have our special forces folks who come right out of the jungles of Central America. These guys get into the real shit. All branches of military service are involved in providing this training and direction to law enforcement. In New York City alone, the police crackdown on disorderly areas in the city has been involved with paramilitary policing, quote, we get them in our sights, we draw a gun, we fire. Life and death situation? No, it's not a simulation. And indeed, this is a system that was developed with the Firearms Training System, or FATS, the leading worldwide producer of interactive simulation systems designed to provide military training in the handling of civilian situations. In 1985, FATS first developed its video simulation system for police military application. Since that time, they have sold 2,200 systems in over 30 countries, and the FATS simulation system now has been integrated in every police department in the United States, enabling the users in, quote, law enforcement agencies in the military to prepare scenarios to integration of video and digitalized projected imagery for the application on the streets on a day-to-day basis. The president and CEO of FATS is Peter Marino, formerly the director of the Office of Technical Services of the Central Intelligence Agency. This special weapons and tactics SWAT team usage integrates with the Naval Air Warfare Center Training System Division and developed a weapons team engagement trainer, WTET, prototype, providing tactical engagements for team members of military special forces integrated with SWAT teams and law enforcement personnel with particular instruction on close quarter combat. It should be pointed out as well that FATS contracted with the Office of Naval Research, producing a commercial version of the weapons team engagement trainer, which will be hiring private policing and prison system application across the United States. According to Lieutenant Colonel Dave Grossman, the former Army Ranger and paratrooper and author of On Killing, this modern training in policing uses what is essentially B.F. Skinner's operative conditioning techniques to develop a firing behavior in the soldier. The training comes as close to simulating actually military combat conditions as possible. What we are in the presence of here is the conversion of our people, once again notably the African-American poor, but all working-class people, into targets of opportunity for a Gestapo-like militarization of what passes for policing in America.
Ralph, it is beyond the African-American population. They are the first target because of the resistance that was evidenced during the Watts rebellions, the Newark rebellions, and other rebellions throughout the United States. But if we look at Great Britain, where there are similar anti-terror and destruction of civil liberties, anti-terror legislation and destruction of civil liberties legislation taking place as we speak. A study that was done by Guerrilla News Network, November 27, 2003, stated that the British government declared a state of emergency 12 times since 1920, and in each case, the state of emergency was declared during times of industrial unrest. That means during times of labor struggles. And so we see in Great Britain, for instance, where they're introducing an Anti-Terrorism, Crime and Security Act of 2001, which would allow the government to indefinitely detain suspects without trial, what Guerrilla News Network states clearly is that this will be used for labor unrest, the inevitable labor unrest with the continuing onroads, the assault of the capitalists against the working class of Great Britain. This is also true in New Zealand, where sweeping powers have been put into effect with the counterterrorism bill. And incidentally, the New Zealand government says that with their counterterrorism bill, that they are adopting now the United Nations conventions aimed at fighting global terrorism. But what's interesting again, and this relates to what you were saying about the assault primarily against the African American communities first, and now also the Latino communities throughout the western part of the United States. We have with the anti-terror legislation in New Zealand clear wording that makes it a crime to have economic disruption as a crime. And so we see that these anti-terror legislations and the increased militarization of the policing operations in the United States are aimed also at the working class throughout the United States. And it was Attorney General Ashcroft who imposed Taft-Hartley and said he was going to bring out the military to cover the docks when the ILWU was in contract negotiations with the shippers on the West Coast. And so we also see, Ralph, with dissent. At the time of the demonstrations against the World Trade Organization, the Seattle Weekly, December 23, 1999, noted a Justice Department official who asked anonymity confirmed that the elite U.S. Army Delta Force, quote, operating under its cover name of Combat Applications Group, CAG, was in Seattle a week in advance of the protests. Under the control of the Joint Special Operations Command at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, the contingent took up residence in a motel, fanned out downtown dressed as demonstrators, some wearing their jungle greens. The Delta Force, a violent global strike force, was operating under the rubric of the Joint Task Force Civil Support, the forerunner of the Northern Command.
Well, as you were describing, Maya, and as we cited in our program last week in Miami, the particular focus of the expansion of the FBI's powers touches on the workers' and the unions' resistance to the drastic cuts in standards of living. In fact, what is defined as disrupted to the social order and interruptive of the policing powers of, required to prevent terrorism is economic disruption, interference with police activity, and creating any obstruction to social processes in the United States. This is a blanket authorization to target in particular the objection to the resistance and the demonstrated protest against the imperial application of preemptive war and the right of workers to organize a fight back against the contracting out and the sending of their jobs to places where people can be paid starvation wages under FTAA as under NAFTA. This has a particular meaning now with reference to today's article in The Guardian in London by Julian Borger, Israel trains U.S. assassination squads in Iraq. Israeli advisors are training U.S. special forces in aggressive counterinsurgency operations, including the use of assassination squads across Iraq, U.S. intelligence and military sources acknowledged yesterday. The Israeli Defense Force has sent urban warfare specialists to Fort Bragg in North Carolina, the home of U.S. special forces, and according to two sources, Israeli military instructors are now present in Iraq as well. U.S. forces throughout Iraq are using the tactics that echo Israeli operations in the occupied territories, sealing off centers of resistance with razor wire, raising buildings, and enveloping entire villages in barbed wire. The secret war in Iraq is about to get much tougher, and the U.S. Special Forces teams are already behind the lines inside Syria, to kill those who may come across the border. Quote, this is basically an assassination program. That is what is being centralized here. This is a killer team, said a former senior U.S. intelligence official who added that these tactics and the enhanced cooperation with Israel are an integral program. This is bonkers. This is insane. Here we are already being compared to Sharon, and we're confirming it. And more than that, these people are being trained at Fort Bragg by the Israelis. A well-informed intelligence source in Washington stated, and they will not be confined to Iraq. They will not be confined to Iraq. Which brings us to a detailed study that we cited in previous programs 1 year ago, December 9th, 2002. A long study by Gordon Thomas called Mossad, the world's most efficient killing machine. And in this study, he describes the operation of Katzas, the Mossad's assassination units, which are not confined to the Middle East, but in fact are now being unleashed both in Great Britain and I emphasize this, and in the United States. Here's a description. Meir Dagan knew he already commanded something his recent predecessors had never accomplished to the same degree. Respect. When I was fighting in Lebanon, I witnessed the aftermath of a family feud. We took charge. There was a head we split open with brains on the floor. Around this person lay the wife and the children, all dead. We scooped up a handful of brains and swallowed it. This is how you will now operate. Otherwise, someone will eat your brain. His every word held them in thrall, even if they sent a shudder through some of his listeners, hardened as they were. Killing enemies who cannot be brought to trial is deep embedded in the instruction that the Mossad killers prepare. Only the Mossad can carry out these operations. Rafi Eitan, the legendary former operations chief of Mossad, told me when we sat together in his living room in a north Tel Aviv suburb, I always try to kill when I can see the whites of their eyes, so I can see the fear, so I can smell it on their breath. Sometimes I use my hands, a knife, a silencer gun. I never felt a moment's regret over these killings. And Meir Amit, director of the Mossad, stated, we are the official hangmen. We are the executioners. And we know how to go about our task. Our actions are all endorsed by the State of Israel. When the Mossad kills, we do not break a law. We fulfill a sentence sanctioned by the Prime Minister of the day. These are the operations that are now being prepared in Iraq. These are the training units that are present at Fort Bragg in the United States. These are the Katzas, the killer squads that are permeating the American policing in this society as well. Call it by its name, the fascistization of the United States.
As Lieutenant Colonel Dave Grossman, the former Ranger author of On Killing, stated, there is now within the policing departments desensitization, denial, and conditioning, behavioral engineering, the training of reflexive quick shoot ability, as we saw with Amadou Diallo. The police are programmed to kill. Now, this is also going on with the mass detentions and the mass militarization of dissent. Excuse me, not detentions, but the mass militarization against our protest movement. Just recently at the School of the America protests, when 10,000 people converged at Fort Benning, which in Columbus, Georgia, over 10,000 people were gathering outside the gates of Fort Benning, Georgia. 10,000 people for a nonviolent, peaceful vigil. And it's a vigil that has been going on and growing for score of years. But what happened that was different this time? This time, the Columbus police, they forced everyone to go through police checkpoints on a public road, Benning Road. There's a public highway that leads into Fort Benning, and every single person had to go through a handheld metal detector test, and the person who refused to do it was arrested. The ACLU had taken this to court, and the judge refused a stay until this is heard in the courts. What they ruled was this was a matter of public safety. Public safety, peaceful protests where everyone has to go through a metal detector, a virtual search of everyone participating, a way to squash peaceful protest. Ralph?
The Berkshire Eagle, Maya, on December 8th. Miami Mayor Mayor Diaz called for the police actions as a model for homeland security, an overwhelming show of force to deter anarchy. Indeed, this time the cops didn't wait for protesters. They set upon peaceful demonstrations by union members, retirees, students with rubber and students, and they struck them with rubber bullets, pepper spray, stun guns, and riot sticks. Non-embedded journalists were targeted and falsely arrested. University of Massachusetts freshman Edward Okaki ended up in a neurosurgery intensive care unit after several days in police custody, during which his head injuries were treated with Tylenol. The police said he was threatening them. Mr. Owaki is 5'6" and weighs 130 pounds. And the Berkeley Eagle describes... The Berkshire Eagle...
In Pittsfield, Massachusetts.
In Pittsfield, Massachusetts, said the AFL-CIO, whose members came to petition their government for redress of grievance, got a snoot full of tear gas, a whack upside the head for their trouble. They treated us like we were the enemy, said Fred Frost, president of the 150,000 member South Florida AFL-CIO. This was no longer my city. Meanwhile, the Greater Miami Chamber of Commerce gave the chief a plaque for the amazing professional work that you did, unquote. We are in the presence of the acknowledged militarization of the police, the targeting of working class demonstrations, and of the trade union movement itself. This is the significant meaning of the militarization of the society, the preparation for a military coup, and the orchestrated preparation of our public for the next staged 9/11 event, preparatory to the suspension of constitutional norms and the takeover by the military in a formal sense and not just in daily practice. This is a scenario that is not intended by us to intimidate our listeners, but on the contrary, to mobilize them. There is nothing inevitable about this process. It is an expression of the deepening crisis of a degenerate system, and it is a signal call that sleeping giant, the American working class, through its trade union organization, is confronted by a state prepared to deprive it of the nominal right to protest and of the elementary integument of a democratic society. The resistance must begin in a sustained way with the understanding of what we are up against, and the task before us is nothing less than the sweeping from power of this handful of ruthless people who have seized control of our society and who have openly declared themselves ready to resort to the methods of fascism in the United States.
You've been listening to Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, Testing the Waters, Military Rule in America, Part 2. Both Parts 1 and 2 are on our internet, www.takingaim.info. You can reach us at 212-209-2953 or at 707-552-9995. Write to us at takingaim@wbai.org. We'll be with you next week.